In human culture, education is the way that we make human beings human, which is to say, how we teach people to live in community. Sociologists call this process socialization, which is basically the process of getting social, and teach us that it happens almost everywhere, from the hospital room where a child is born. And we had a wonderful example of that with our first son, socialization beginning on day one, because they would take these kids and they put them in those little baskets that they put them in the hospital. And for all of the male children, they put in like little footballs and things as if they were going to wake up and play, you know? And for all of the girls, they put in little dolls and things like that that they might snuggle, as if either of them was going to do that. But that's how early socialization begins in American culture. So socialization from the hospital room where the child is born to the home and TV and church. Socialization occurs both intentionally and inadvertently. But the place where it is supposed to occur most intentionally is in the school. Today I'd like to look at American schools and ask some questions about schooling and community. What do our schools teach? What's in the curriculum? What do our schools teach by the way that they teach? What's in the hidden curriculum? What do our schools teach us about the nature of human beings? What do they teach us about individuals and community? How do we learn community? How can we use schools as learning communities that might enhance our larger communities, which should also and always be learning communities? Students in the 60s addressed many of these questions, and I'd like to begin there. James Thurber said once that it's better to know some of the questions than all of the answers, and the 60s can help us think about some of the questions that we still confront in the 1990s. One of the most important organizations of the 60s was Students for a Democratic Society, and we might begin with their conceptions of what it meant to be a student in America. The Port Huron Statement from 1962, the first manifesto of Students for a Democratic Society, echoed many of the themes of earlier political personalism, and that included the Catholic Worker Movement, the anti-nuclear movement of the 1950s, the Civil Rights Movement. The section on values, its most elegant and original contribution, especially articulated these connections. It called for the end of the, quote, depersonalization that reduces human beings to the status of things. In defining the perimeter of human possibility in this epoch, the statement confessed that we regard men as infinitely precious and possessed of unfulfilled capacities for reason, freedom, and love. It called on people's unrealized potential for self-cultivation, self-direction, self-understanding, and creativity. And it suggested that moral realignment should precede political realignment. Emphasizing moral over electoral politics, or even political structures, the statement committed the students to a search for transformative social values. One of the interesting things that I do when I teach my class on the 60s is I'll give students this statement of Students for a Democratic Society from 1962 and just let them read it, and then I say, well, would you sign on with this organization? Almost all of them would, because most of what is in the statement is now pretty much common knowledge. It's a stage at which Students for Democratic Society was neither as radical or as violent as parts of the organization got later in the decade. And I think many people in America now could feel very comfortable with a lot of what's in this supposedly radical document. And that's an indication of how much the 60s have changed the United States. Calling for human independence, but not egoistic individualism, the participants at Port Huron emphasized a sense of community as essential to human fulfillment. People needed personal links that superseded the loneliness, estrangement, and isolation of modern society's functional relations. The statement even suggested that politics have the function of bringing people out of isolation and into community, thus being a necessary, though not sufficient, means of finding meaning in personal life. So very much like the Greeks, they thought you had to be involved in political life to have a full and rich personal life. The idea of participatory democracy, which was a term that they, I think, coined and used quite a lot, applied personalist precepts to the processes of political life. Participatory democracy assumed the importance of individual human beings, and it invited them to cooperate in decentralized situations in naming their political problems and in shaping solutions to them. Like John Dewey, 60 students believed that the process of participation was not just good for politics, it was also good for the people who participated, helping them develop their full capacities as persons. The students of SDS assumed that the private life of the post-war charter, which is the third, it's up there somewhere, the fourth term that's up on the board there, was not enough for human fulfillment. Post-war charter is a term that Richard Flax uses to describe what went on in the 1950s, where essentially he says that that Americans sort of renegotiated the social contract with their government, and the renegotiated social contract said, as long as there's economic growth and we get more stuff, we won't bother you if you don't bother us. And it led to what the students would call passivism, P-A-S-S-I-V-I-S-M, you know, politics, to the people being fairly passive about politics. And the student movement of the 1960s was a reaction to that. Clarifying problems and choices, politics, they thought, should connect people to knowledge and to power so that they could collectively work out their destinies. Participatory democracy complemented the representative institutions of republican government by adding a personalist perspective to democratic theory. Participatory democracy was one important way in which students tried to harmonize means and ends. As Don McKelvey said in 1963, we must strive to create, here and now in our everyday functions, a certain mode of relating to people which will serve as a counterweight for both ourselves and others to the manipulative, dehumanizing, coercive relations that we so rightly criticize in the society all around us. Participatory democracy led students to create parallel institutions like the freedom schools and community unions in order to begin building the new world within the shell of the old. At its best, participatory democracy was not just politics for the community, but politics as community. In the section Agenda for a Generation of the Port Huron Statement, SDS's founders described the development of their radicalism. We are people of this generation, bred in at least modest comfort, housed now in universities, looking uncomfortably at the world we inherit. America's youth had been brought up to believe in the ideals of freedom and equality and of government of, by, and for the people. Lawrence Wright, who's written a wonderful memoir of the 1960s, recalled that he grew up expecting to inherit his father's sense of certainty about American mission. Since America was on the side of freedom, he said, I wouldn't have to worry about my conscience. Duty would take care of me. When I pledged allegiance to the flag, as I did every school day and every scout meeting and every week at Sunday school, I believed in its promise of liberty and justice for all. As we grew, however, the SDS students recalled, our comfort was penetrated by events too troublesome to dismiss. First, the permeating and victimizing fact of human degradation, symbolized by the Southern struggle against racial bigotry, compelled most of us from silence to activism. Second, the enclosing fact of the Cold War, symbolized by the presence of the bomb, brought awareness that we ourselves and our friends and millions of abstract others we knew more directly because of our common peril might die at any time. We might deliberately ignore or avoid or fail to feel all other human problems, but not those too. In both civil rights and civil defense, students experienced the difference between myth and reality, between preaching and practice, as sheer hypocrisy and indictment of American society. As Godfrey Hodgson suggests, the young saw Americans governed both socially and politically by a split-level morality. They questioned the ethical consistency of a society characterized by great affluence and great poverty, by democratic declarations and Negro disfranchisement, and by peaceful promises and nuclear buildup. From a personalist perspective, this hypocrisy was indefensible, so the New Left set out to make American society live up to its ideals. While the civil rights struggle and the bomb were foregrounded in the Port Huron Statement, SDS also focused on the ABCs of apathy, bureaucracy, and college. One of the most important themes of the Port Huron Statement, and really of the whole student movement of the 1960s, was public apathy. The American democratic system, they said, was apathetic and manipulated rather than of, by, and for the people. On college campuses, according to one observer, students don't even give a damn about the apathy. And this apathy toward apathy bred lives of privatized routines. The students of Port Huron saw apathy as both personal and institutional, and they set out to reform institutions to support people who cared. The Port Huron Statement was intended to combat apathy and fatalistic realism of the futilitarians by providing hope for a new politics. Like Thomas Merton, the Catholic monk who was not really part of the Catholic worker movement, but published often in the Catholic Worker and whom these students knew, the students posed empathy and activism against apathy. In his 1966 Letter to an Innocent Bystander, which is one of Merton's most beautiful essays, he contended that the term innocent bystander was an oxymoron, and that witnesses to a crime had become accomplices by their inaction. Like Thomas Merton, the New Left of the early 1960s viewed the Adolf Eichmann trial, which is what another one of Merton's essays was about, as an extended morality play that made Eichmann the epitome of the bureaucratic functionary, apathetic to his own complicity in a monstrous wrong. And the moral of the play for them was that in a context of official wrongdoing and state-sanctioned evil, the individual bears a responsibility for resistance to institutionalized evil. While the older generation pointed to the example of Munich to justify the containment policy, which was the reason for going into Vietnam, the younger generation pointed to Nuremberg to justify their dissent. And it's real interesting how the generations, the one generation looked at the beginning of World War II, the other generation looked to the end, and made really different decisions about what was more meaningful. Their post-Nuremberg ethic meant, according to one activist, that every individual is totally morally responsible for everything he does. 17-year-old Jewish student Bob Ross, for example, joined the sympathy picket lines at the Ann Arbor Woolworths and Kresge's in 1960 when they were protesting racial segregation because, he explained, it was the Jewish thing. If you're silent, you're complicit. For some members of the New Left, this empathy and engagement was the Christian thing, too. Inspired by the ways in which Martin Luther King applied Christianity to social issues, many students re-examined their own religion and found it more radical than they had believed. Much of the humanism in the New Left is Christian, explained Dale Brown. The affirmation that institutions should serve people, not people institutions, is but a restatement of Jesus' teaching about the institution of the Sabbath in Mark 2:27. Seeing the world through the eyes of the dispossessed had biblical precedence, for scriptures too exalted the poor and condemned the rich. Even many students who rejected the established religions of the American establishment still persisted in a moral mission. Carl Oglesby described his commitments as Christian atheism, but I think it could also be called an agnostic liberation theology. And I think a lot of the 60s is inspired by what is essentially a liberation theology, most of which they got from Martin Luther King and the Civil Rights Movement. More than most people now remember, SDS argued that one of the main obstacles to a democratic society was a bureaucratic society. They also observed that apathy flourished in bureaucracies. The Port Huron Statement especially condemned the cumbersome academic bureaucracy, which increasingly incorporated the value standards of business and the administrative mentality. In both the universities and other institutions, bureaucracies reduced persons to their functions and separated people from power. Bureaucracies and academic empiricism stifled the search for truth and moral enlightenment. As they said, our professors and administrators sacrificed controversy to public relations. Their curriculums change more slowly than the living events of their world. Their skills and silence are purchased by investors in the arms race. Passion is called unscholastic. The questions we might want raised, like what is really important? Can we live in a different and better way? If we wanted to change society, how would we do it? Are not thought to be questions of, quote, a fruitful empirical nature, and thus are brushed aside. Still, the Port Huron Statement contended that American universities could be the seedbed of social change. Like C. Wright Mills, the members of SDS hoped to redefine the vocation of the intellectual and the institutions of higher learning in America. The students imagined a new role for intellectuals. They could be voices for the powerless. By clarifying the social structures of American society, intellectuals could offer analyses that led to social change. As Richard Flax recalled, we wanted to find ways to reconnect intellectual work with the needs and realities of the disadvantaged and oppressed, to combine the analytic and the reflective with engaged action, to reform the university so that it could be an arena within which the redefinition of the vocation of the intellectual could occur. Such university reform, the Port Huron students thought, could be substantial because the universities were part of the problem as well as part of the solution. Like Peter Morin of the Catholic Worker Movement, the students worried that, this is one of Morin's easy essays, it was written I think in 1938, bourgeois colleges turn out college graduates into a changing world without ever telling them how to keep it from changing or how to change it so as to make it fit for college graduates. Student concerns increased in 1964 with the free speech movement at Berkeley, where it seemed that the administration was trying to keep ideas and actions disconnected, and in the teach-in movement that started in 1965, in which students and faculty tried to get education to pay attention to contemporary issues like the Vietnam War. When the teach-ins began in 1965, there was not one course on Vietnam at an American university. In both of these, the students worked from a personalist ethic, which demanded that colleges and universities consider the whole person in a whole society and not just a brain in a bureaucracy. They demanded that education be relevant, which was one of the big words of the 1960s, both to themselves and to their social situation. At one of the major rallies of the free speech movement, Mario Savio claimed that Students are permitted to talk all they want, so as long as their speech has no consequence. Savio also framed his ideas within a personalist perspective. In the most quoted excerpt of his speech, he criticized the impersonal depersonalization of the university, noted students' complicity with their own dehumanization, and called for individual commitment to a revolution of the heart. There is a time, he said, when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart that you can't take part, you can't even tacitly take part, and you've got to put your bodies upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all. Opposing the organicism of the human body to the mechanism of social institutions, Savio called for the humanization of the university, for an education that treated students as whole persons. The free speech movement dramatically expressed ideas earlier expressed in the personalist idiom. Paul Goodman's Growing Up Absurd, which was published in 1960, had claimed that many students were strangers in their own lives, searching for a deeper meaning to life than American society could provide. They wanted to be persons, not just personnel. They wanted vocations, not just the vocationalism of American education and business. The futures and careers for which American students now prepare, said Goodman, are for the most part intellectual and moral wastelands. Those futures provided money for people to participate in the chrome-plated consumer's paradise, but they compromised the principles most dear to the young. The personalism of students' protests also made them sensitive to the scientific objectivism of the universities. They worried that science, and especially behaviorist social science, threatened dehumanization and manipulation. Like C. Wright Mills, they doubted the neutrality of the so-called objective methods, and they objected to the moral schizophrenia of an academic ideology that separated knowing and doing, learning and living. As the student Enragés kept telling us, said noted Professor Kingsley Widmer, intellectual commitment can no longer be kept separate from moral passion. In part, the confrontations over the paternalism of the colleges and universities derive from different conceptions of human nature and human motivation. Colleges and universities and the parents they represented believed that behavior could be molded by following prescribed sequences of courses and experiences. They used the extrinsic rewards of grades to encourage an educational instrumentalism that deferred gratification to the future when a salary would replace grades as the pay for intellectual work. Students, on the other hand, took a more organic view of persons and personality, following the widespread ideas of humanistic psychology, which is really important in the 1960s. They assumed that self-actualization was the natural trajectory of human beings, and they saw educational structure mainly as a scheme of social control. The process of student protest was often as important as the product, because protest often brought students into a community that they didn't feel really very much at college. And I think many people who participated in protests in the 1960s will remember them as one of the most intense and lively times of their lives. The communal experience of radical politics was an important result of the student movement. We have the makings of a community, Professor William Appleman Williams told the University of Wisconsin teach-in in 1965. At Columbia, one professor observed, an intense communal life emerged in which students at last enjoyed a shared commitment and purpose. Like the Catholic workers, the civil rights marchers, and other activists, students discovered and rediscovered the pleasures of purposive politics, the ways in which collective action created communities more substantive than the consumption communities and lifestyle enclaves of mainstream culture. Today, in the 90s, many of the criticisms of 60 students still apply to American education. For the most part, education is still a specialized activity occurring in specialized spaces, designed in the long run to produce specialists for jobs in an economy that's increasingly specialized. For the most part, as parents and students tell us over and over, education is not, quote, the real world. This is one of my pet peeves, because what that means is that I'm not real. And I have this sort of vague sense that I am. But I actually did hear a student one time make a distinction between people and professors, which I thought was very interesting. Well, you know, people do this and professors, you know, they do that. And I thought that was also very interesting, because the idiom does suggest to us what we do think about these things. Yeah.
They say that at West Point, the cadets there are taught how to win the last war. Maybe at the universities, the professors dust off their notes from 20 years ago and teach how to live America a few years ago. And so, that being the case, is this where then this new concept would enter in at the universities to combat the time lag in what the students are learning?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think the dominant mode of education into the 1960s was to do a kind of classical education where people would learn a whole variety of things that they were told would be applicable at some time. But they never saw professors apply the idea that they were being taught, say, in philosophy classes or things like that. And they wanted to see that happen. And I think that's still the case, that we still teach a lot of stuff with this sort of vague sense that it will be useful to somebody sometime. But I think when students look at adults in the United States, they don't see very many of us that are applying the ideas that we learned in our college educations. The routines of American life tend not to depend very much on the liberal education that we had in college. In the 1960s, just because of the different things that were going on, students were not willing to put up with an education that asked them to pay attention to the past so that they could act in the present. They wanted the education to also pay attention to the present. They were not willing to discard the past, though, however. Some people think the students were willing to throw out everything in the past, and that simply wasn't the case. What you find in the late 1960s, for example, is a real shift in student majors from business, social science, and things like that, to philosophy, literature, religion, things like that. What I would call a kind of politics of meaning. Students are really interested in those things, and then they're interested in applications of those things. And that begins in the 1960s. It carries over in some places to now. The Paracollege at St. Olaf allows students to do that kind of thing, but it's an experimental college that was instituted in 1969 and really came out of this uproar of students. So it tends to be more attentive, I think, to the sort of present needs of students than other institutions are. I'll come back to this in a minute.
Are you familiar with the format of the Evergreen State College?
Yeah, Evergreen and the Paracollege feel like sort of brothers and sisters sometimes because they're both experimental colleges of the same sort. Evergreen, I think, has a larger faculty and really a larger student body than the Paracollege does.
I suspect that they would resent being referred to as experimental.
Well, I would wish that they would still keep thinking of themselves as experimental. The Paracollege has made a career out of trying out experiments, which then are so good that the regular college takes them up. And we've just finished doing that. We just went through a general curriculum change at St. Olaf, where a lot of the things that the Paracollege have been doing, particularly interdisciplinary education, moved into the mainstream of the college. And now we're at a point where we're saying, well, now the regular college is pretty much like we are. It's time for us to invent something new to try. And I would love to see Evergreen do that, too. I think that otherwise things get just too staid, even in colleges like Evergreen. Well, anyway, I was talking about the real world, and I want to come back to 90s education. In the 90s, education is seen mainly as an individual thing. Robert Spaeth suggests that individualism is so rampant in higher education today that it goes unnamed and often unnoticed. It is our way of life because, he says, we are Americans. The individual we call a student is also often a stunted form of human being, a mere brain brought to class by a body which has little or nothing to do with a student's education. As students in the 60s suggested, education too often fails to challenge the whole person, the integrated intelligence, emotion, body, and spirit. In The Peaceable Classroom, which is a wonderful book about higher education, Mary Rose O'Reilly responds to this challenge by asking herself a question. The question for me, she says, is how do we teach people who are profoundly, even stubbornly, spiritual beings? I think we assume that spiritual is the last thing they are, because it is perhaps the last thing they will let us know. But, she suggests, what if we were to take seriously the possibility that our students have a rich and authoritative inner life and try to nourish it rather than negate it?
That is right in that, I think, 20 years ago when our son went to MIT, he said a surprising number of MIT students were changing to become ministers. Yeah.
That's very interesting. I wouldn't think that trend would be going on right now. It seems to me this is a really instrumental time in American higher education, and that people would be looking to have a career. There's, I think, a more of a careerist orientation now.
There are a few suicides, too.
There are a lot of, there's a lot of stress and a lot of suicides. There's a tremendous amount of stress in higher education now. And some of the stresses are related to the pressures that we professors put on students. One of my students told me many years ago, says, "You professors keep our minds so busy, we don't have time to use them." I thought, ooh, this is very interesting. And in many ways, that's what that meant was, I'm just doing this particular thing that you're asking me to do, and I don't have the time to do the synthesis that I really ought to be doing between these things. Or I don't have the time to think about, to ask what I think is the most important question of higher education, which is, so what? You know, you're teaching me this history, but so what? Tell me about that. I don't have time to think about that so what question, because I just have to do the whatever it is that you've assigned me to do. I'll talk a little bit about some ways that I try to anticipate that so what question in some of my courses. The individuals that we call students come to college to get an education and a credential for a career, not necessarily in that order. We assume individualism so much that we say that a student gets a college education, not that a community gets a college-educated person. The word gets, too, is problematic because it implies that education is a form of property, owned, transportable, transferable, worth something, investable, a possession as much as a process. It also implies that education is an extractive process, getting something that somebody else, presumably the professor, already has, or mining an inert material. We assume that in the process of education, the individual changes while society stays the same. We assume that we are helping students adjust to the 20th, or now the 21st century, without asking if the century is worth adjusting to. In the 60s, Paul Goodman reversed these priorities, putting the community first. And this is maybe my favorite quotation about education. "Think about the kind of world you want to live and work in," he advised students. "What do you need to know to help build that world? Demand that your teachers teach you that." And I think too often what we're teaching students isn't that. It's something else. It's what we've learned through our graduate educations. And it's amazing, as you watch people sort of mature in a college setting, that so many of us come in with the narrow specializations of our graduate training. And I know when I went to St. Olaf, I was teaching the American History Survey, and I just came in, I taught it pretty much the way that it had been taught to me in graduate school, partly because I didn't have a lot of time to think about anything else at that point. But partly because if you've been in graduate school for 5 or 7 years and you've seen the survey done 5 or 7 times in that period, you figure, well, it must be worth something because they keep doing it over and over. And you don't do the kind of questioning that would make it better or make it more applicable or more relevant. And I think, at least for me, as I've been at St. Olaf now for 20 years, you get some time to think about those things and then to do some things to change it. Goodman was asking for a broadly vocational education in a culture that looked and still looks more for career advancement. When education operates in this vocationalist, which is not to say vocational, way, it contributes to many of the problems it hopes to cure. It produces individualists without the community support to allow them to resist many of the social pressures and social traps of American culture. A vocational education, in contrast, gives students a sense of their gifts, including their traditions, which are a gift to them of the past, and the society's needs, and lets them listen to the spirit to see how the one, their gifts, can be connected to the other, society's needs. It prevents problems like the one that Linda Hasselstrom describes in her essay, Enrooted in the Land, which is somewhere here. This is an essay called Addicted to Work. "My second husband's son lived in a small Minnesota town until he graduated from high school. His responsibilities there were simple. He had to get out of bed in the morning, get dressed, go to school, study, maybe take out the garbage or babysit, go to his job as a stock boy in the grocery store. His parents expected him to stay sober and get acceptable grades. His school expected him to learn from books how to be a responsible citizen and to believe in the high morality of politicians, even though the news rang with examples of their corruption. Instead, he got low grades and misbehaved. He felt unimportant and frustrated. His mother complained that he lost his jacket, couldn't remember where he put his books or his English paper. I didn't approve of his confusion or its results, but I think I understand it. Except for the babysitting, none of his jobs was important. He knew the world was full of problems. He was bursting with youthful energy and confidence, but he couldn't believe anything he did would improve the world." Then she's a rancher. He comes out west to live with her. "When he came to the ranch, if he forgot to feed his horse, she didn't eat. If he neglected to fix the fence, the cows got out and several people and horses had to work hard for a day in the hot sun getting them back in. All of us freely explained what he'd done wrong. If he didn't turn the water on the garden, the sun fried the food we were planning to eat this winter. If he lighted a fire and forgot to watch it, he might start a prairie blaze that would burn the winter grass of a dozen ranches. After a few days, he stopped whining when we got up early. He'd work beside us grinning and wouldn't quit until we did. What he did and didn't do mattered. And I think in many cases in American education now, what we do doesn't matter. I think we play a kind of big game of what Neil Postman and Charles Weingartner called let's pretend. Let's pretend this is important. Let's pretend this is interesting. Let's pretend either one of us cares about this. And let's pretend for a whole semester. Due, however, in part to the experiments of the 60s, there are also educational experiments working to integrate learning and community. Theodore Sizer, who's one of my favorite educational writers, has addressed these issues for secondary schools in his three books, Horace's Compromise, Horace's School, and Horace's Hope. And what he ends, I mean, he's really a complex and wonderful writer, and I feel like I'm doing him violence to sort of summarize, but what he ends up with is an education that's entirely interdisciplinary, because he just doesn't think that the world works in disciplines all that much. Almost every action that we take is really an interdisciplinary action. I once described driving a car, for example, as something where a biological being gets in a mechanical artifact that's constructed by physics and creates a combustion in order to move through a social landscape that's created by political entities, created and regulated by political entities. I mean, just about every discipline in a college is involved in driving a car. If you really wanted to understand driving a car, you would have to know all of them. But we don't do it that way. We only do them one at a time. And that tends to fragment the world and make it disconnected and disintegrated for students. And so Sizer says we ought to address problems like driving a car. That would actually make a great course. What does it mean to drive a car? And then to take the disciplines of the college that would help you understand what it means to drive a car and apply them, so that by the end of the semester, a student would have a complex sense of what an everyday reality would be about. I'm actually going to do a class something like this second semester next year. We're close enough to the Mall of America, and I'm going to do a whole class on the Mall of America. What does it mean? And I can go all. I will go way back in American history, probably farther than the students want to know to do that. But just go back to sort of the beginnings of commercialism in American life in the marketplace. And if any of you have computers by the end of next year, you will be able to find what the students have done on the web. Because the second thing that Sizer suggests for high school education is that the work of students ought to be public. Too often the student stuff just comes to me, I get to read it, I hand it back, grade it. They may or may not look at the grade or the comments, and ultimately they usually hang on to it until about junior or senior year, and then in April of their senior year they throw all of it out and it's gone. And they don't take it very seriously because they know I'm the only one that's going to read it, and professors aren't real people, so why should we care? When you structure assignments so that they're public, they care a whole lot more, particularly if you structure them so that their peers are going to read them. I'm not anticipating something I was going to say a little bit later. One of my favorite assignments is I teach an introductory American studies course that's on the moral ecology of everyday life, which is basically just about things like driving a car, or watching TV, or drinking a cup of coffee, or having a Coke, or something like that. And one of the assignments that I came up with years ago now, and it's actually sort of famous in American studies now, is the American Studies Museum. Each student picks an artifact from the college campus, can be a can of Coke, can be just anything that they find, a banana, a room key, anything like that, and they have to write a 15-page paper on the cultural meaning of that artifact. This is exactly their response. How could you possibly write 15 pages about a room key? There's nothing there. It's just a key, and it's just, you know, it's a little piece of metal. Well, you know, you start thinking about a room key, and it's a lock. It's a lock. It goes on a door. It's about boundaries. It's about in and out. It's about private and public. It's about protecting possessions. It's about materialism. And students have. I mean, I actually have a student who wrote a beautiful essay on a room key. These are the kinds of things that you try to get students to do. And then they have to do the even harder part. After having written the 15-page paper, they have to condense it to one-page single-spaced. And we take their one-page single-spaced condensation, and I get a room in the student center, and I get red and blue burlap and put this over tables in the room, and we put the objects on display, and the one-page single-space papers. And then in the course of the semester, students have also done an analysis of an ad, where we say, you know, here's an ad. Ads don't just tell you about products, they tell you actually more about culture than they tell you about products. So here's an ad, analyze it for what it tells you about the culture. And they also do one-page single-spaced analyses of ads. And then they post those side-by-side on a poster board. We put those up in the American Studies Museum. And then last year I had a couple students who said, well, we think this is nice and it's analytical, but it's not. There's nothing literary or artistic in here. So they picked poems that had to do with the kinds of things that we were studying, a lot of Florence Ferlinghetti poems, as a matter of fact. And they did these on computers and typed them up, and then they put them on the floor so that you could read these poems as you were walking around the museum. And this year I'm doing a class on culture and nature at the college, where we're going to do a cultural geography of St. Olaf, and I'll send students out and they'll take photographs of particular scenes at St. Olaf, and then have to write cultural explanations of those scenes so that they begin to understand the place that they're in. So like, St. Olaf is all Norman Gothic architecture. Why Norman Gothic architecture? Why would you do that? Why wouldn't you make it look like a warehouse or something like that? What is this distinctive kind of architecture of schools? Why did they choose Gothic at a place like this, for God's sake? So that's one thing, and that's a big thing, kind of obvious. But other students will do things like they'll take a picture of a fire hydrant or a sidewalk. Sidewalks are really wonderful to do, or the grass. We have this one big green in there, and there's grass in there. So what's that grass doing there? What would the college be like with or without the grass? Could we put AstroTurf there, and would it be as good? Obviously, no, you can't put AstroTurf in the middle of a college campus. The grass has to be there, because there has to be the sort of sense of natural contemplation that goes back to Romanticism of the 19th century. So they'd have to bring in some of that and some landscape paintings and things like that. They need to know a lot in order to do these things. But so we'll have those on display there somewhere also. So anyway, this comes from what Sizer suggests in his book, that stuff has to be interdisciplinary. All of those projects are interdisciplinary. It has to be practical, he would say. But he doesn't mean just practical instrumental. It has to be about a big question practical. And the big question I always tell students that they're studying at college is, what does it mean to be human in a particular time and place in the physical universe? That's a good question for a college education. What does it mean to be human in a particular time and place in the physical universe? And that's where disciplines are useful, because each discipline has an answer to that question. You go to, say, the religion department, for example, and religion says one of the things it means to be human is to be related to a supernatural being, and people have done that in different ways in different times, and we can explain to you that what that might mean. Or you go to the English department, and the English department says one of the things it is to be human is to have language capacity and to use that language to tell stories, and stories determine the way that culture operates. That would be one thing that would happen there. Historians would say that one of the things that it means to be human is to be in relation to other human beings who lived in the past. Whereas I tell students, usually at the beginning of history classes, I say, dead people rule your life. You might as well get to know them. That's true. You know, all of the institutions that they inhabit, all of the language that they speak is a language and institutions crafted by dead people. So they need to figure out what these dead people were about in order to understand who they are. Or you go to the math department, which is always my hardest, because I didn't have to do math in college, because I started in college in 1967, and in 1968, because of all the student uproar, they dropped all the requirements. So I didn't do math, and my science in college was anthropology, as it turned out. This was not one of the good things about the 60s, to have dropped all of the requirements, but some of us took advantage of it. But anyway, all the disciplines would answer a big question like that. Another thing that Sizer says is that the educational work that students do ought to be applicable. It ought, or to use the 60s terminology, it ought to be relevant. Or to use another terminology that I use, it ought to have carryover. They ought to be able to be doing something that they might actually do when they're, quote, in the real world. And that makes the college more real also. You might want to analyze an ad when you're in the real world, because ads are going to be asking you to do all kinds of things. And so the ability to analyze an ad is a useful skill in the real world. You might want to be able to think about what artifacts are, how social relationships work, or things like that in the real world. And so it seems to me that they ought to have carryover. And then, as I said, you ought to make public exhibitions of your knowledge, because whatever kind of work you do, essentially that's what you're involved in doing, is public exhibitions of knowledge. If you're working on a project with somebody and you're in a group that's doing it, when the group gets together, essentially when you make your presentation, you're making a public exhibition of your knowledge, and you might as well have some practice of it. Okay, well, that's Theodore Sizer. Parker Palmer also helps us to think about learning in community, especially in his book, To Know As We Are Known. which the Holden Library has. He argues that schools and colleges are and should be communities of truth. And he probably addresses the issue of community more closely than anybody else. Community, he says, is clearly central to four issues that have been basic to the life of the mind. First, the nature of reality, which is ontology. Second, how we know reality, epistemology. Third, how we teach and learn, pedagogy. And fourth, how education forms or deforms our life in the world, or ethics. Palmer suggests that an educational system that assumes, as ours generally does, that individuals are the unit of instruction and that they learn through objective, analytic, and experimental methods will result almost inevitably in a culture of competitive individualism. Students in such a situation are encouraged to focus on the performance of the self, but not necessarily on the introspection of the self, and to consider the world as separate, distanced, and manipulable. Grades teach them that they are on their own, since nobody else gets their grade or GPA, and grades suggest that they should focus on proving that they know what the teacher wants them to know, instead of improving their character and critical thinking skills. This hidden curriculum helps them to develop what Palmer calls moral schizophrenia, in which 80 to 90% of them believe the world is going to hell, and 80 to 90% of them think that their own personal future will be fine. Objectivism, Palmer thinks, is essentially anti-communal. He finds hope in several developments. Science increasingly shows us that the nature of nature is communal, that we are all a part of a biotic community, as we talked about the other day. We are beginning to understand that we learn not individually, but in community, since language, which is inherently communal, is the main way that we know. As Palmer says, nothing could possibly be known by the solitary self, since the self is inherently communal in nature. You become a self as you learn language and become socialized. In addition, new areas like women's studies and Native American studies are reminding us of old ways of knowing: relational, organic, bodily, intuitive, reciprocal, passionate, interactive, and communal. Since the world is communal and knowing is communal, Palmer says, schooling should be communal too. He claims that real learning does not happen until students are brought into relationship with the teacher, with each other, and with the subject. Although we can learn many things superficially, he says, we cannot learn deeply until a community of learning is created in the classroom. Probably the most important way to do this is to structure classes so that students see themselves as connected to each other, to a community of learners that dates back to antiquity, to a wider community that supports them, to the society that shapes their desires and expectations, to some sort of spiritual roots. Mary Rose O'Reilly suggests, therefore, that the first goal of education is to encourage students to explore the inner life. The first goal of education, if we think it has anything at all to do with values, is to bring students to a knowledge of the world within, its geography and anthropology, depths and heights, myths and primary texts. Our second goal, she says, should be to help the student to bring his subjective vision into community. The classroom, then, must be a meeting place for both silent meditation and verbal witness of interplay between interiority and community. And what she gets there is actually two things that don't happen a whole lot in classrooms. The interiority, the sort of really reflective stuff, often doesn't happen because students have to work on things so fast. And what she's saying, you need to give them time to think. They need that time to really be reflective. And then the other thing is the kind of community that comes out of conversation that's based on that deep thinking. A lot of times you get conversations in the classroom, but they're fairly superficial because you haven't given them time to go deep. And so O'Reilly is suggesting that we need to give time for that. In general, she suggests we want students to find their own voices, but we want those voices to be found in a community. Finding a voice is a political act. To be voiceless is to be oppressed. And then some of the things that I described earlier are ways that I try to create community in the classroom. A lot of the projects that I have students do are collaborative. When they do the cultural geography, for example, groups take the pictures. They then select one picture to write about, and all of them contribute to the analysis of the picture. It helps them do the critical thinking. They have to sort of narrow down. They get a whole bunch range of ideas from three different people, and then they have to narrow down, what are we going to write? Okay, so, and that's a really important process to go through to decide what's important. The other thing that goes on in that is what John Dewey would call collateral learning. In doing that, they learn a whole lot of stuff that doesn't show up in the paper, and that collateral learning is really important. And we forget a lot about it in college education because we're mainly focused on tests. Tests end up to be the tail that wags the dog a lot of times. But that collateral learning is really important, and I think you get more collateral learning when you're in a group process than otherwise. And as I said, people, they just take those kinds of assignments a whole lot more seriously when they're in conversation with other students, and then they've got to present it in public, than a lot of others. It's not enough, though, I think, to keep our communities in the classroom. I also think that the campus, at least the campus of a college like St. Olaf, which is small enough, should be an intentional community, dedicated not just to the pursuit of truth, but also to exemplifying the possibilities of American life. A college is not the real world, or at least most people don't think it is. But if we were more daring, we might provide models for the real world. St. Olaf, for example, has tried to think collectively about its resource flows and to move in the direction of sustainability. So far, as I said the other day, we actually haven't done much, but we've been thinking about it. We have tried to convert some of the farms we own to sustainable agriculture. We are restoring a prairie and wetland that's at the bottom of the hill that St. Olaf is on. These are small steps that place the college in community with nature, and they are an example for others. I think I'm going to pause here. I think I've talked a long time, and maybe I'll ask for some questions. I have some other things that I could say, but this might be a good place to stop. Yeah.
But you're talking there about students not being worth much, really. It doesn't matter who you are, it's what you do. I think about my job and my bureaucracy that I work in, and we do what society claims is very valuable work. We protect children. But as you're talking, I'm realizing how powerless I really am. That they tell us it doesn't matter who does this job as long as it gets done. It seems to be the air that runs through the place. Now, those of us who are in that particular investigative unit, we're really close to each other and take good care of each other. But the notion of the system is that it doesn't really matter who does the job. And that's just really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, that's I think, is the nature of bureaucracy, is that the who doesn't matter, the function matters in bureaucracy.
All matters. And anybody can do any particular job. Replacing a flash.
Not anybody can do that, but anybody trained to do that can do it. And that makes parts interchangeable, which makes bureaucracies like machines rather than like organisms. I do want to say a good word for bureaucracies, though, since I've just beat on them for a while. The one good thing about bureaucracies is that they make things efficient in ways that are sometimes useful. So that sometimes you just want a functionary. You just want somebody who can do a particular thing for you. And you don't want to have a whole lot of human interchange with that person, because if you had human interchange with all the people who are functioning for you in an interdependent world, you wouldn't have time to do anything yourself or to function for them. So there are ways in which bureaucracies, where we want some of the functions of bureaucracies. I think American society has gone overboard with it. I think that we are too much functionaries to each other. I think a lot of my students think of me as a functionary and not as a person. They think of me as, you know, simply a historian, not as a person who practices history, which I think is a distinction that's important.
Well, I think that, just kind of thinking out loud right now, that the trick is to pull meaning out of it anyway and do things of value despite what they think, whoever they are.
Right. And part of it, as somebody was saying the other day, is to inhabit the bureaucracy that you belong to, and to make it into what you want. Actually, to do what Goodman said there, what kind of institution do you want to live in and inhabit in the future? What do you need to do that? To demand that your teachers teach you that. For those of us who are already educated, you can do a lot of that stuff by getting on the committees. When we revised our curriculum, for example, I volunteered to be on the General Education Committee. It took us 2 years to revise the curriculum. It was a lot of very boring work. But essentially what it meant was that when something went to the faculty, we had first shot at it. It was our draft. It was our ideas. We set the agenda for the faculty, and that's important. And in the institutions that we inhabit, we can do that. We do have power in those institutions. I suspect that we have power in many more institutions than we think we do. I think that in my town, for example, people who show up at school board meetings and talk just even more than a little bit, since that's so rare, get heard. Or people who work for school board members to get them elected get heard. I think that we have lots of power that we don't use, and one of the mysteries of American life is that we don't use it. Although I think that goes back to that post-war charter I was talking about.
When you were talking about education as community, I know a little about it, but the way the university grew originally, wasn't it almost more of a community in the way it functioned than now. In fact, even as I think of Oxford, maybe, or a place like that, is it some of the rudiments of medieval roots that it's maintained. There's a sense of living in a community, interacting maybe more with faculty. I don't know if that's...
Actually, that would have been true in the United States even up until the 1870s. Almost all colleges, the universities begin in the United States in the 1870s, but almost all colleges before then would have been intentional communities of that sort. And that was because they were extraordinarily small. It's real hard to do mass education in community. University of Minnesota now, I think, has 58,000 students. At a place like Harvard, for example, in before 1860 or so, students did what was a very rigid curriculum. You didn't have any, or hardly any, electives at all. You just did what you were supposed to do. Students all lived together, but the president of the college was responsible not just for the administration of the college and the fundraising and things like that, which our presidents are mainly responsible for now. He had to write up like all of the behavioral stuff on them. So, you know, who got check marks for coming to dinner on time, and what wing of the dormitory was unruly. He had to calculate all of that stuff. He calculated all of their grades from all of their classes, and he taught every student the last class that they had in college, which was moral philosophy, because the idea of a college at that time was that you learned a lot of diverse things, and then in the very last year, you took a course from the college president on moral philosophy, and that was the one that was going to integrate everything for you and show you how to make it active in the world. What happens in the 1870s is we adopt the German model, which has an emphasis on specialization and efficiency, and it basically says, if you can divide the task up into smaller and smaller pieces, you can analyze those pieces more efficiently, and then theoretically, in the kind of building block model of education, they'll all come together again. What's happened in the 100 years since then is that we have analyzed more and more things in that way, but we haven't put them back together again. I mean, it seems to me that the building block model of things is largely mythical. It's a wish that things will come together, but the way that we actually do education, they won't, because people simply don't talk to each other across disciplines. At major universities, it's very rare to find somebody in the, say, in physics, talking to somebody in the English department with any frequency at all, or teaching across those boundaries. At smaller colleges like St. Olaf, that can happen. And in a place like McClure College that's interdisciplinary, when you have a faculty meeting, it's not all physicists or all historians. You have a faculty meeting of a whole lot of people. And we do a lot of team teaching there. I have actually taught with a physicist at St. Olaf. We once taught a course called, and I've taught a lot of them, more history and English than anything else, but one was America on Stage. We were teaching 20th century American history through drama, and the entire reading for the course was drama, 42 plays that we read in the course of the semester, and then it was my job to say, what are these plays telling us about the history that's going on at that particular time? What is the history that's going on there? I think that's a really interesting thing for students. And another thing that team teaching does for students, it shows them that there's not truth with a capital T, because the professors disagree about this stuff. And I taught with a professor who thought that the classics were sort of the English canon. And I think that something like Dick Tracy and comic strips and things like that are classics, you know. We had some differences about what counted.
I'm just kidding. You know, probably know more about this than I do. My nephew is going to Yale this fall, and that university appears to be organized, their colleges, around numbers of students and buildings rather than disciplines. Do you know?
I think they have a residential system that does bring students into conversation more within their residences, and there are masters of the residences or something like that, so that they have more interdisciplinary conversations than many
He's
places.
He's assigned to a college.
Right.
And the college has some man's name on it. It's not a discipline, and it doesn't matter what his discipline's going to be.
Yeah,
there are 300 students in his college.
That's
all I know. You know.
One of the trends in higher education now is to get more consumer friendly, really. Students were just getting fed up with being numbers at major universities, and so there is more of an effort to get to know students in that way.
Cross discipline, create collegiality at a younger age.
Right. Yeah. It still works better at smaller institutions. Not at St. Olaf, but at some places in Wisconsin, you take your first class in your first semester with your academic advisor. so that your academic advisor actually gets to know you in some more significant way than, say, I do when I only see a student for a couple hours the first week to sign up for a course, and then I may or may not see them after that, depending on their interest in talking to me.
Well, I was a student there in World War II at Yale, and it is a college by terminology, and they have these we would call them dormitories, and communal dining. And then they have several of these, and together they make a university. That's the way Yale was established 100 years ago. And so the word college only really refers to the physical building and the dormitory rooms and where they dine, okay. Not the curriculum.
The university or college is a discipline.
The university, most universities would be made up of colleges that are collections of disciplines that are akin to one another.
Yeah, the University of California has a system where, at Santa Cruz, where the college where you live is where you also take your courses for the most part. You eat there, you live there, and your classes are taught within that, although obviously you can take something across the way, but it does have that system of
How did we lose the sense of the, well, you said it was adopting the German model, but the sort of the last year pulling it all together, that was just left.
Yeah, I mean, moral philosophy as taught by in most of the colleges of that were around in the 19th century was both religious and ethical kind of thing. And as we were moving to a model that was based on scientific objectivism, it didn't seem that somebody ought to be telling you what you ought to do. And so there's a book by George Marsden called The Soul of the University, where he says basically that over the last 100 years, what we've done is we've dropped out most value questions from the universities and focused on knowledge. And students and universities are terrific for generating knowledge. That they are, they're wonderful at that. And that's it's an important and valuable function. My sense of education, and particularly at the college level, is it ought to be geared to generate knowledge in the service of wisdom. And I don't think that we very much think about wisdom at all. You don't find it very much in college catalogs. Usually when people are talking about their universities or their colleges or things like that, they talk more about information. And we talk about being an information society, information overload, and things like that. I would love to have some wisdom overload in this country, but we don't have that. And that's partly because we let information come at us so fast, we don't have time to have the wisdom that we might have if we thought about it.
Given that, you know, as we move forward into our computer age and all that, I've seen where some colleges or some, you know, learning institutions are starting to offer curriculum that are remote via the internet and so you lose all that community all of a sudden of people actually being together and in dialogue with each other. But it is also being supported to be more consumer friendly to people out there. What do you think the implication of that?
I mean, I think it has two implications that are at odds with one another, and I think you've kind of identified both of them. One is that it will make education more democratic. I think the internet does offer possibilities of a sort of a tremendous amount of democratic information flow. It will make it very hard for people to decide what's good information and what's bad information. That's one of my problems with the internet. And my other sense is that I don't know, people have faces on the front of their heads because they ought to look at each other more than just at computer screens. It seems to me that we will lose a lot by going entirely to a virtual or a computer or a cybernetic education. There are many things I think that we can learn on them, and I will have, in my classes in the fall, I will have students searching out websites and things like that and doing some analytical stuff with stuff that's on the web, because I want them to get familiar with that as an information source and to be able to evaluate it critically, which in a way is what college is about, sort of how to evaluate information critically. But I wouldn't want to do that with students, 30 students who are all over the country, and just communicating by that. The Pear College, though, one of the things that we're thinking about doing as we think about how to be an experimental college at this particular time and place is thinking about doing a curriculum where we might do a 3-year college education that would have students on campus all of their first year doing what we would call core studies. They might do internships in the summer after that first year. We might require them to be out of the country their entire second year, but in contact with their advisor and the whole community. It'd be a cadre of maybe 90 students, in contact with those 90 students by internet. So that we would have established the community face-to-face. We would then move it overseas into a whole number of places, but maintain the communication during the second year and then bring them back the third year, again, face-to-face. And we think that we might be able to gain some of the advantages of the internet without losing the community. But we think that the community needs to be founded in the face-to-face interactions that a place like St. Olaf is really good at, and particularly the Parr College, where, I mean, I just simply, every year I have a number of students who graduate who are my friends because I have not gotten to know them really well.
What's the enrollment of St. Olaf and how does it compare with Carleton?
We're at about 2,800 and they're at 1,900. So we're one of the biggest liberal arts colleges in the country at 2,800. That's specifically a liberal arts college.
Do you see second career or second degree students at St. Olaf? That was one of the things we had at MSU.
Do you mean advanced degree students?
Well, they have a first degree, and then in the real world, when they got out there, that was not satisfying. And they came back, many of them came back, like into nursing or veterinary medicine or physical therapy.
No, partly because we don't have professional programs. We don't see very many of those students. Ours is almost entirely an 18 to 22-year-old student body, partly because of the demographics. We're in a town of 8,000 with another college, and it's simply, there's not that much adult education that can be done. We have a continuing education program, but it's not very big. If we were in the Twin Cities, we could do a lot more like that, and the University of St. Thomas has.
You know, the trend now in K through 12 is integration of different disciplines, and it looks like a fairly good trend as long as it doesn't go overboard as the pendulum swings back and forth. And it sounds like you guys are integrating somewhat to it.
Well, I am in my mind, but I wouldn't say St. Olaf is as a whole.
But I noticed in my class, I have sixth grade, and I noticed that students, when you do try to do more integration of disciplines, how you get a little resistance. They'll say, well, this is math class. I'm not going to do any writing here. What does English got to do with math? Or what does math have to do with history? And yet, really, they all go together.
Right.
Yeah, that's because we have separated so solidly that, for heaven's sakes, the math teacher never talked to the English teacher until recently. They hardly knew their names. Had a conversation. So the kids pick that up very quickly.
Right. I mean, we are taking some institutional steps to move so that students don't ask those questions. And one of the things that we've done is that we've taken the writing class out of the English department and moved it across the curriculum. So I'll be teaching a first-year writing class in the fall. The culture and nature class that I talked about will be a first-year writing class. And so that students won't come to a history class and say, why do we have to write? They'll know we have to write in all of the things that we do at St. Olaf. We've made a commitment that that's one of the intellectual skills we want all students to have and to be able to apply in all kinds of disciplines. So, and even the math department has to have a way of gauging the writing quality of their students.
In Minneapolis, they're starting now a special program of integrating the disciplines of music and art and learning. This is just the beginning program, and they hope to carry it through to all the schools. And it's a special curriculum that has been set up, and they have, I read the program once, but a neighbor of ours is one of the teachers. So I'm not too versed in it, but this might be something akin to what you're wondering about. It's a new project anyway. And especially, they've been wanting to toss music out.
Yeah.
And we musicians aren't very happy about that.
Yeah, the only thing I would worry about in an integration like that would be that it's an actual reduction in the amount of art time that students got. I would worry that that would be an actual reduction in the amount of art time that students got. that they may be doing it for reasons of efficiency. We'll throw all these things together and we'll do it more efficiently than we would if we were delivering it separately. If it is in fact a curricularly based project, then I could approve it, but
I can't argue that point because I'm not too versed in it, but they seem to think that it's highlighting the other.
Yeah, I think that's very helpful if you can do that.
Yeah, it's an integrated.
We our kids were in the Minneapolis Public Schools for a long while, and when we started there, we were sort of looking up the different kinds of schools that were available to us, and one of them was an open school. And we had looked at the sort of test results that came out of various schools, and this school got great test results in everything but math computation. And so we happened to see the principal before we enrolled our kid there and said, you know, what's the deal here? And she said, well, frankly, we don't care a whole lot about math computation because people can use calculators for that. So what happens here is that we're behind in math calculation, but when you get up into the upper levels and you get into analytical kinds of things, our students do just fine.
That's unfortunate. That's the attitude about many educators. It isn't important to study music. You don't earn money at that.
Actually, what they find, though, is that the students who are engaged in music do better academically in almost everything else.
Right.
There's a tremendous carryover from the... there's a tremendous carryover and correlation between music and almost any other kind of intellectual skill. And St. Olaf, which has five choirs and an orchestra and a band and something like that, is really proud of that connection.
Well, they haven't been shown that they actually score higher in searching knowledge.
Yeah.
IQ tests.
Yeah, they do have
Portfolios, that seems to be...
Yeah, actually, portfolios is one of the things that Sizer suggests. He calls them exhibitions because he wants them to be public, but I think a lot of us are doing portfolios.
Hope it doesn't go overboard and we throw off the grade, so I hope it's kind of... Would I say a combination of both?
I would like to throw out the grade, actually.
You would?
Although I'm in such a minority at St. Olaf that this is not likely to happen. We don't do grades for some things in the para-college, and I think that students actually get engaged in a different way that's more exploratory and offers more to their total education than the ones where they're graded, where they have to be paying more attention to what the teacher wants. Mm-hmm. But what we do in the para-college is we give them narrative evaluations. So I will write a page on a student, and I will say, this student has read these books in this tutorial. They've read them with this amount of sophistication. They've written five papers of this length. The writing was of this quality. And the last paragraph is usually about what I think the student needs to pay attention to as they're going on. That kind of information is what they really need.
Okay.
And that can go into their file and their transcript too. And what we find actually with para-college students who do a comprehensive examination and a senior project in their senior year in college is that they have done the kinds of things that graduate students are going to do. And we have St. Olaf is great at getting people into graduate and professional schools, but the para-college is marginally better than the general college at doing that because of the kinds of disciplines and the ways that students have owned their own education because they make their own majors and they're almost always interdisciplinary. And then they do these projects, some of which can be just extraordinary. I had a student once who came to me, and I was not her first advisor, and I was not competent to be her advisor. She wanted to do minority women's education, and I said, well, one way to do a project that shows what you know is to do a syllabus for a course that you might teach in this. She said, okay. She started to work on it. She ended up with a 67-page, single-spaced syllabus for a course that began on March 21st, the spring equinox, and ended on the fall equinox, that met every day, that had a residence on St. Olaf Avenue, that had a garden in the middle of the football field. She had, and it was structured around the cycles of a woman's life, from birth to childhood to adolescence to courtship to relationships to midlife to aging to old age. And she had short stories and novels and poetry on all of those topics by a whole variety of minority women writers. And she had songs that the students would sing in their homes. She had recipes for meals that they would cook together that came out of some of the traditions that she was talking about. It was just amazing. And this was only one part of four of her comprehensive exam. And then the other thing that happened with her that was really wonderful was she had to do a senior project, which is some way of focusing down on the stuff that you had done broadly. And at one point in her senior year, she was getting really irritated and angry about academics. I mean, she was just really pissed off about it. And I said, well, you know, one way you might approach this anger that you've got is to talk to some of the female faculty who are on your committee and ask them, you know, what they think they're doing and how they value that. And you might make that your senior project. And there's one woman in the English department particularly who does a lot of her teaching in exchanges of letters with students. And I said, well, you might ask her to do that. Or you might ask, she had three women on her committee and I was her advisor. So I said, you could ask any one of them and I'm sure that they would be interested in doing this. So about 3 days later, I get this letter that begins, Dear Jim. Instead of picking what was the logical choice was her advisor, she'd pick me. And we did this series of letters back and forth and she would write these letters and she'd ask, you know, why do you do this? Well, when you're teaching, what do you think is important about your teaching? Or something like that. Or she'd write about something that was really irritating her at some time and I'd reply to that. And then she would write about something that she was reading, and I would read that and then reply about it. And I would say, I know a lot about education. I said, well, you know, Neil Postman and Charles Weingartner and teaching is a subversive activity say this about that. And so she'd read a little bit of that, and then she'd write back. And we ended up with about 80 pages of letters by the time that she finished. And that was her senior project. The exchange of letters was her senior project, and my work, in a way, was a part of it. Now, to me, that's a really wonderful kind of educational experience, that the kind of thing that, if we weren't so focused on efficiency, we could offer to more students.
Mm-hmm. Did you get extra credit for all that work you put in?
No, I didn't get any extra credit at all, but it was intrinsically wonderful.
She gave you a grade?
Yeah.
Actually, she didn't. But actually, and she was really irritated that we had to give her a grade. This was one of the things in the prior college that wasn't graded. She passed, as you might imagine.
And so whatever happened to her project?
I still have it. She has a copy, I have a copy too.
Is it occurring somewhere in some community?
She decided she didn't like academics enough to get into it. She moved to Washington, worked in a bookstore in Olympia for a while. then went to Mexico, where she worked with the Augsburg programs that came to Mexico. She married a Mexican national. They've just moved back to California, where she is at the Pacific School of Theology, planning to be a minister, and it will be wonderful. She will really stir up some congregations. I think we may be getting close to dinner, or maybe even second dinner by now. So maybe we should stop.
Thank you.